This past December, Gary traveled to Miami to perform in the Miami debut of the concert Violins of Hope. This unique and very special concert was played entirely on violins collected from survivors of the Holocaust. I am delighted and honored to welcome the renowned violinist Gary Levinson to the program. Welcome, Gary.
Thank you.
So, Gary, as I mentioned earlier, you began studying the violin at the age of 5. What drew you to the instrument at such a young age?
Well, my parents are both professional musicians, and I had classical music in the home, really, from birth. And one of the great memories that I have, probably at the age of 2 or 3, besides the fact that my aunt's also a violinist, are the recordings that my father would have. And, you know, since we're both of a certain age, we know that the media was coming in primarily through the radio, TV, and recordings. And the sound of the violin was always something that I was very attracted to. And having heard David Oistrakh, the great Russian violinist, live, pretty much sealed it for me, because I said to my mom, this is what I want to do. And that was probably at the age of about 3 and a half, which is a little bit too early, but they did get me started. And then that was too early for me. I was just not mature enough to really practice and approach it properly. So they waited till I was 5, and then it was kind of a done deal. I knew, I think, from the first 3 or 4 months that this is what I wanted to do with my life, and it was something that was always a calling from the very beginning.
That's amazing to have that kind of knowledge at the age of 5.
Well, I was lucky also because of the people that surrounded me. You know, it was just one of those things where I'd never had bad teachers because both my parents are professional musicians. Very lucky that way.
So you were quite young when you arrived in the United States. Can you tell us a bit about your early life?
The one thing that is the most prominent in my memory is the early life in the Soviet Union, not to be confused with present-day Russia, is it's very regimented. If you want to do something with your life, be it music or sports or really anything, there's kind of a way to do it. And if you want to do something else, you're not going to be supported really by any institutions. So in order to have gone into even the earliest schools, you do have to pass an audition, and then there are jury examinations. So I felt like, unlike, let's say, the Western education, where the sky is the limit and you can try it any different ways, there was pretty much one way to proceed if you were going to be getting the professional education as a musician. Now, having arrived in the United States at the age of 10, it was very interesting because, once again, my dad being a legendary double bass player, won the job of principal bass of the Minnesota Orchestra. And I started studying with the concertmaster of the Minnesota Orchestra, Lee Foley, who is to this day one of my favorite people. But I do remember him telling my parents that, you know, there's a million ways to do this. And they were like, you know, what do you mean a million ways? He's 10. There's one way. So it was one of those things where we just kind of, it took us a long time, relatively long time, to figure out really how the education was going to be different. But I will say that looking back on it, I do prefer the Western education because of its attention to creativity and the ability to take each individual and sort of garner their individual talents rather than sort of a groupthink mentality, which at first probably garners better results. But in the long run, I'm a bigger believer in the Western education.
Let's take a break now and go to your recording of Ravel's Tigane, first performed in 1924 in London.
Thank you.
Welcome back. We're speaking with master violinist Gary Levinson. So Gary, at the age of 21, you were already playing with the New York Philharmonic. You've had the opportunity to play with some very distinguished musicians throughout your career. How has performing with people such as Zubin Mehta and Yo-Yo Ma influenced you as a musician? Is there any one person who might have influenced you the most?
Well, it would be unfair to say that having worked with Leonard Bernstein for the last 2 years of his life was not, if not the most influential musician of my career, certainly in the top two. You know, his love for music, his world citizenship, how he viewed not only his career, but his place in the world is perhaps unique before and after his life. And I was lucky enough to work on his violin concerto, the Bernstein Serenade, with him. I was lucky enough to have made 4 orchestra recordings with him and spend a lot of quality time, not just talking about music, but, you know, invited me to his 70th birthday party, things like that. With it, really, I treasure those memories and the lessons that he taught, because not only was he the great educator that you see when we watch the young people's concerts, which to this day, just about every orchestra tries to replicate that in their education program to be able to reach a mass audience on what was then a primetime broadcast on CBS. To be able to do that is really quite magical. And it was really all hinged upon his vision and his passion for classical music. So he was perhaps the most influential for me as we pass on not only our love for classical music, but our love for education and our love for our culture, which at times gets blurred as we are inundated, you know, with different kind of media and just a lot of the noise that happens in life. So he, of course, was amazing. I think of Zubin Mehta as my musical godfather because he was just so supportive after I won my job at the age of 21. And as over the years, as we've worked together, I admire his musicianship. I admire his support for Israel. And of course, I admire his support for young musicians, which he to this day continues the way he's passed his baton to his successor at the Israel Philharmonic is just really magical. And he's a citizen of the world, much like Lenny was. So he's a great, great mentor and someone I admire very much.
Tell us about a few of your many albums. What inspired your album, New York Years?
The New York Years album was really done when I came to Dallas to become the senior principal associate concertmaster. And it was, it's a complicated title because it was all about the music that I learned and premiered for myself. For example, some of the first performances all took place in New York. It wasn't like it was the closing of a chapter of New York because I play New York all the time. My parents still live in New York. We're in New York for various reasons, 5-6 times a year. But that's the reason for the name of the album. It was recorded, of course, in New York. My engineer, Adam Aveshouse, lives in New York, and, you know, it is my connection to New York, which was the lifelong connection. The soon-to-be-released album, which is the music of France, is all French music, which is with Tigan that we listened to earlier. Classics for Everyone is an interesting CD that was pretty much done in order to make classical music ubiquitous. So it's a lot of popular music, and it's really aimed at children and at people who may be intimidated by classical music or don't know much about it, and they want to listen to shortcuts of things that are, you know, very familiar tunes, and sort of to be a runway to perhaps more complicated classical music and just to get people of all ages involved in it.
Well, you certainly come from a very musical family.
Yeah, my wife is a concert pianist, and my mom is a concert pianist. My aunt, as I mentioned before, is a concert violinist. So the musical family is really started with my parents. So we sort of continue it. And with any luck, the kids will have, I know they'll have a lot of love for music, but we don't know exactly, you know, how they'll continue. But I do know that they are very well versed in various kinds of music, including all kinds of popular music, which they teach us a lot about.
So it's on both sides of the family, this musical legacy.
That way.
That's wonderful.
Exactly.
Let's take a break now and listen to the very beautiful Faure Sonata No. 1 in A minor, composed by French pianist and composer Gabriel Faure in 1877.
Thank you.
Talk about Violins of Hope, a very powerful concert that you performed in Miami this past December. These violins, all collected since the end of World War II, have the common denominator of having belonged to Jews before the Holocaust. Collected by father and son, Amnon and Avshalom Weinstein, there is quite a story behind the Violins of Hope project. Please share the story with our audience.
Well, the Violins of Hope were collected by the Weinsteins really from after World War II, and I was lucky enough to visit with Amnon Weinstein in Israel in 2018. They're important instruments, not necessarily because of who made them, but the function that they served, and certainly the function they serve today, because the collection of the instruments, many of them, according to Amnon, they were really, before the Holocaust, they were just used for weddings, and they were used by working musicians. They were not like the Strats and Dalgases that we have million-dollar instruments. They were just a tool of the trade for these people in Poland and in what became the Czech Republic. And they represented how they made a living. But the collection of these instruments, whether they came from the internment camps or all the other camps, they kept the spirits alive for these people. They kept them together. They kept their Jewish identity together. And I think they represented and continue to represent the incredible resilience of men and women who could have easily lost hope, but they refused to. because of the music that they made and what these instruments meant to them as a connection to their not only Jewish identity, but their human identity. And when the Nazis tried to dehumanize them as well as exterminate them, this was one of the tools that they had in order to keep their humanity. And I really admire that.
Let's take a short break and check in with Rabbi Levi Friedman for our segment, Inspirational Interlude.
This week's topic is the power of faith. Let me tell you a little story about the power of faith. A rich man once brought a pair of shoes to the local shoemaker for some repair. The shoemaker's work, however, was shoddy. The rich man asked the shoemaker how he can deliver such poor quality. The shoemaker replied, "I barely make ends meet. I have a family to feed and children to marry off. With all my worries and stresses, I can barely concentrate on my work." The rich customer returned the next day with a gold bar. He hands it to the shoemaker and says, "You no longer have to worry. Whenever you need some money, sell a piece of the bar and you will have what you need." Overjoyed, the shoemaker put the gold bar in the cupboard and threw himself into his work. Now with a clear mind, the shoemaker's work improved dramatically. His reputation began to spread and he was soon known as the best shoemaker in the region. Business picked up and the shoemaker was now a rich man. One day, the shoemaker meets a sad and worried man. The man tells him of his challenges, his worries, and his constant doubts. Shoemaker hands the man the gold bar and says, "Take this bar. Whenever you need it, sell a piece of it, and you no longer have to worry." Upon returning home, the man, still racked with doubt, takes a hammer and breaks off a piece of the gold bar, only to discover that it's a bar of lead with only a thin layer of gold. Upset, he runs back to the shoemaker, angrily demanding to know why he would play such a cruel trick on him. After a brief pause, the shoemaker says, "I believed in the gift I was given, but you couldn't separate yourself from the doubts. The secret to my success wasn't the gold bar, it was my faith." So while it's true that the bar may at times only be gold-plated, with faith and imagination, it has the power to light up our life.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Levi. So, Gary, I'm curious to know how you became involved with the Violins of Hope concert. You were obviously born well after World War II. Is your personal history or that of your parents and grandparents a factor in drawing you closer to this project?
I think they are, of course, a factor. I think every Jew, really every human being is a factor in this. But my main impetus on this was that the people in Miami were very much open to it, and we all felt like the younger generation, the generations that are in their 20s and 30s, they are really not necessarily as well-versed in the history of the Holocaust and in the personal stories of these people. And we wanted to do what little we could through the language of music and the Violins of Hope to educate them and to maybe raise awareness for them so that they will do that both for their generation and the next generation. As we spoke before, there is so much media and there's so much information out there today that it's almost impossible to tell how much of it is factually correct and how much of it is hyperbole. And in order to tell that story, to do it with music, it sort of focuses and clarifies a lot without using too many words. Also, I'm very proud that we have a commissioned work for this concert that was specifically composed for this event, encompassing what the event means, what historically it means for all of us. And I think the culmination of all of this, the commissioned work, the playing that we have, and the Miami community had made for a sensational event, something that is unique in all of the Violins of Hope events. And I do love that I was able to put it together, and we have so much support both in the Miami community and in the world community at large.
I understand that there are 30 violins, as well as some violas and cellos in the Violins of Hope collection. Others who have played on these instruments attest that they feel as though they're walking in the footsteps of their original owners and giving voice to them through their playing of the instruments. That sounds like such an amazing and meaningful experience. Did you have a similar experience? Can you please share your experience with us?
Yes, I do have a similar experience. I'm very lucky in that I get the use of the Stradivarius that is owned by the Dallas Symphony. It's a Golden Period Strad, and it's from 1726. So every time I touch that instrument, I am in a very special club, if you will, of not only great violinists that came before me, but really the craft of the great master Antonio Stradivari. So in a way, when you touch an instrument that was played by the klezmer violinist in the 30s and 40s, especially knowing what role that instrument played in their survival in the camps, there's no question that we connect as musicians, but more important, as people, to be able to kind of tell their story through music and through words. As I said before, I really think the most important thing for us with these concerts is to make sure that the next generation not only knows the facts about what happened to these people and how they kept their humanity in very, very difficult circumstances, but most importantly, to make sure that we don't pretend that this can never happen again and we shall never forget. So I do think that these instruments play an incredible role. And for us as instrumentalists, we really are in a very special place to communicate that on many different levels.
So Gary, tell me a bit about how the music for the concert was chosen. Were you responsible for selecting the program? And did you work in collaboration with the Weinsteins?
Yes. Well, we wanted to play music that was obviously connected to the Holocaust. Composers that had something to do with Jewish themes, but also we wanted to play some timeless classical music, such as we're playing some Mendelssohn. Obviously, Mendelssohn died long before the Holocaust, but in many circles, especially with Hitler, the music of Mendelssohn was suppressed because his grandfather was Jewish. And there were a lot of anti-Semitic tropes about the music of Felix Mendelssohn. So we have the commission piece, we have Jewish composers, and we have music of Mendelssohn, which is gorgeous and timeless and does remind us that even in the 19th century, anti-Semitism was alive and well, and we should understand that as we live in the 21st century.
Amnon Weinstein, the founder of Violins of Hope, stated that the Violins of Hope concert is not only a memorial to lost culture and people, but it's also an educational tool that reaches young students and adults wherever the concerts are performed. They believe that the violins present the victory of the human spirit over evil and hatred, and that the memory of the millions murdered comes back to life with every performance. Can you tell us more about that?
Well, I agree with it, of course. As you said, I mean, in humans' both darkest hours, when these people really had nothing to live for, according to the Nazis, they found a way to live for something using music as their greatest hope. And I think I'd like to believe that all of them who probably felt like they were not going to survive the camps, they were going to help other people survive the camps. So the instruments and what they represent is the ultimate hope of good over evil. And I think history will show, as it has shown, that we find a way, the good will find a way to triumph. And I do believe that even though this may sound a bit naive, we have people for every generation that believe this, and we have to continue to believe this. Otherwise, the idea of hope is very much truncated. So I do believe that these instruments not only represent hope of the past, but hope of the future.
So Gary, will you be performing any future Violins of Hope concerts? And if so, can you tell us about them?
At present, we don't have plans for it, but I very much believe in the project, and my door is always open if we can do this together. I do believe that many other cities in the U.S. and in Europe are doing it. I know that there was a very big festival in France that did it, so I love the idea, and any opportunity I get to play those instruments and to tell their story from a musician standpoint of view, I very much welcome.
Tell us about some of your upcoming plans. What should our audience be looking for from you in the near future?
My website has all kinds of stuff. I mean, I just premiered the George Sontakis Third Violin Concerto with my orchestra. It was an incredible weekend. It took place in October. And I returned to Russia for a recital. I haven't been there in 43 years. So that'll be a very special event. And I'm just really looking forward to making music with new colleagues and coming back to Miami for the Joseph Gingold Chamber Music Festival, which is always a highlight of my year. It's an incredible 3 weeks of training some of the best students in the world, but also working with some of the best faculty in the world and my dearest friend, Andres Cardenas. So Miami is always in my heart, and the Joseph Gingold Festival is always in my heart. primarily due to the fact that both Andres and myself were students of the great Joseph Gingold at Indiana University. Andres, of course, worked with him much longer than I did. But the legacy of Gingold is something that we love continuing. And it is something that's very, very special to us. And I'm thrilled to do that every summer in Miami.
Gary Levinson, it certainly has been a great pleasure having you with us today. We look forward to hearing more from you in the future and also to the legacy of Violins of Hope continuing. Tune in next week to the Pneumatic Pentameter for a special broadcast of the concert Violins of Hope, recorded live from their debut concert in Miami this past December, only on WDNA. To hear more of the music of Gary Levinson, check out CD Baby, Apple Music, Spotify, SoundCloud, YouTube, and his website, glevinson.com. I wish to thank the Pneumatic Pentameter team for their creative contributions. Susan Gladstone, director of the Jewish Museum of Florida, FIU, Rabbi Levi Friedman of Chabad of the Grove, Linda Olin Weiss, and Spencer Ellenberg, dedicated sound engineer and production assistant. Gary, take us out now with your beautiful performance of Beethoven's Sonata No. 8, Third Movement, and Sonata No. 10, First Movement. Thank you.
Thank you.